If I said to you this morning that I had really good news for you, what would you be hoping the news was? Like if I said, what would be the best news that you could receive today? What comes to your mind already? Now, if you're not sure how to answer that question, think about it this way. Here's how you can know what that would be. What do you daydream about? When you have a few minutes and your mind can just wander a little bit and you have those little fantasies or daydreams about what your life could be like or things that could happen, what do you daydream about? So for example, for some of you, the best news, that thing that you kind of think about when your mind starts going in that direction is she finally noticed me. Or it might be that he finally asked me out or they popped the question and we're engaged, we're going to get married. For some of you, it would be in some way, some form, you got a whole pile of money given to you. You won the lottery. You got a huge inheritance. You already know how you're going to spend it. You start thinking about the car that you could drive or the kitchen renovation, or all of a sudden that problem about how you're going to get a down payment for a house is solved. You've already got that money spent in your mind because you've thought about it and you know, man, it'd be just such good news if all of a sudden I had a pile of money. It might be that you get discovered. That whatever it is that you do really well, somebody notices and they want to put you on stage. They want you to perform in front of a bunch of people. They want you to write books. You're going to be a household name. You're going to teach other people to do what you do really well. You've finally been acknowledged for all of your talents and what you do really, really good. It might be about your family, that everybody's finally going to be together, that the grown children are all coming home and they're going to get along. Maybe it's that you're pregnant. Or that you're going to become a grandparent, or that you're going to become a grandparent again. What is it that is really, really good news for you? And here's the way that that typically works. The way that we figure out what would really be good news is we connect the news with the result. Isn't that true? That's why good news is good, because it changes something in our lives, that it's going to make it better, that we're going to get something or achieve something, accomplish something, or get somewhere that we've always wanted to get. And so the news is really good because it allows that movement to happen for us to get to those places. And we can all imagine what our lives would be like if we got that good news. If that just happened, or if we could achieve this, accomplish that, man, that would be so, so great. We're great at looking forward and imagining. It's interesting, though. I think that if you look at your life in reverse, if you go the other way, if you look back a little bit and you try and evaluate what is it that has got me to where I am today, made me the person that I am or allowed me to achieve the things that I've achieved, it's often the things that we never expected to happen. It's not the things that we sat there and said, man, if this happened, then that would happen. It's the things that we look back and say, I never planned that. That wasn't the thing that I thought was going to happen. I didn't even see it coming. But after that happened, it changed how I looked at this or thought about this or did this. And we look back, and there's certainly times that definitely we planned out our lives and it actually happened and we expected it. But I think almost all of us could look at those times in our lives where we said, that I never planned for. That's something I never expected, good or bad, that's really made me who I am today or got me to the place that I've got today. And I actually think that God works like that a lot, that God works in our lives in completely unexpected ways, that as much as we plan it out, as much as we have a roadmap of what we want our lives to look like and what all the steps are supposed to be and what the result is supposed to be, that life rarely turns out that way, and sometimes it does, and sometimes we take a step that we plan for. But a lot of times, our lives just turn out in ways that we completely didn't expect them to. And we're starting a series, and that's exactly what I want to talk about, is the unexpected ways that God acts in our lives, that God intervenes in our lives and changes our lives, unexpected turns that God calls us sometimes to make. And so this series, we're actually going to be working through the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, a book about Jesus and his life, his death, and his resurrection. And we want to dive in as closely as we can and just to look about what it looks like that God sent his son into this world. And I hope that even if you've been in church forever and ever in your entire lives, maybe you're brand new, but if you've been in church forever, maybe you've read the stories of Jesus over and over, you've heard a million sermons, that maybe you'll be willing to take a fresh look and to take some of our assumptions, put them off to the side, and look freshly at what this book tells us about Jesus. And if you've never heard about Jesus or never really gone through any of these books, I'm excited for what we can learn together and dive into and discover about who Jesus is, was, what he's done for us, and how he can continue to change our lives, even in ways that might be totally unexpected. So if you have a Bible with you, you want to turn to the book of Mark. It's the second book of the New Testament, the second gospel, Matthew, Mark, and then Luke. And Mark is what we believe, most scholars agree, was probably the first gospel written, the first account of Jesus' life that we have, the closest one written to his death and resurrection. And Mark starts out by saying this. This is how the whole thing starts. He says, this is the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. He calls him the Messiah, which is a Hebrew word. It means anointed. It means that this is God's agent of change. God has a special purpose for Jesus. He is the Son of God, which is a powerful title of who he is. But Mark starts by saying, this is the good news or the gospel about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. It's actually where we get the word, why we call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John Gospels, the accounts of Jesus' life, because Mark starts his by saying, this is the good news. Now, if you've been in church for a while, if you've been in Christian circles, you've probably heard this term over and over and over, and we want to stop and talk about it because it's an important one. The good news. Or another way that we talk about, another word we use is the gospel. And good news is just the English translation of a word that means good news or gospel. And in the context that this was written in the first century, a couple of thousand years ago, they had a context for this kind of word. We use it typically in religious settings when we talk about gospel. They used it primarily in political settings. Good news or gospel was a royal announcement concerning a victory or the appointing of a kingdom's leader. So this was something that when something, a big deal happened in politics, when one kingdom overcame another kingdom in war, for example, when they won a battle and they wanted to tell everybody, all the subjects of the kingdom, all the citizens, the people who lived in a certain nation, that, hey, the threat is gone. We've won the battle and life is going to go back to being peaceful. They would have a gospel and they would send out people, because word of mouth was how they spread news. They didn't have Twitter and social media and all the headlines and everything. They would send certain people and they would say, this is an announcement. It's good news coming from our kingdom that we've won the victory. We've won the battle. It's over. We can go back to living peacefully. Or when one leader was replaced by another leader. So if a leader died or was dethroned and somebody else stepped in, they would say, good news, so-and-so is now appointed the leader. And we live in a democratic country, so our elections kind of happen the way that, you know, there's a big run-up to it, and a bunch of us go and vote, and we try and pick the best person or the best party to put into power. And then on election night, we sit there and we watch it on TV or we follow on social media who's leading and then who wins, and they announce, this is your leader. And we all sit back, and whether it's the person that we thought was best for the job or the party we thought would do the best job or not, we kind of quietly accept it. And we know that there's certain things that they can change, and then there's other things that they can't change. There's laws and policies that are pretty stuck, and there's other ones that maybe they can affect change. And we kind of go with it, even if we don't love it. This is a different culture. They didn't live in a democracy. And so this was a time where heralds would come, and they would say, good news, so-and-so is a leader. And they knew that whoever was the leader, whoever was now in charge, was going to dictate what life looked like largely for all the citizens. That they were in charge of the policies and the economy, and things were going to go as they decided them to go. The life of the average Joe was dependent exactly upon who was ruling the kingdom or the country, the nation. And of course, for the people who were announcing it, it was always good news. Good news. Here's your leader. Here's the victory that we've won. This is what life is going to be like under the current leadership. And Mark starts out by saying, this is the good news of Jesus, God's anointed one, the one who's going to bring God's kingdom to you, who's going to bring God's kingdom to your life, to your world, to your culture. He is the Son of God, anointed by him to make change. And that is what your life could look like if you want to live accordingly. And it's amazing because, again, if you're in church for a long time, we've heard that term gospel a lot, and we come to a lot of different connotations. And actually what we do, probably not meaning to do it, but in whatever church context that you may have, if you have one, there's a good chance that we've tried to take that phrase, good news, or the word gospel, and we've tried to boil it down into one sentence or one thing. We use doctrines and propositional truth statements and all kinds of stuff, and we want to know. Well, somebody says to me, what is the gospel? I have a quick answer for them, and I can explain it to them, and all this kind of stuff, and all those things are really good and helpful. Here's some that you might have heard, and again, in different church contexts, we tend to emphasize one thing or another. So you might have heard, when we hear the gospel, we think of things like Jesus heals the sick and cares for the poor. That this is a socially powerful message, that what Jesus did when he saw people who were unwell, he healed them. When he saw people who were in poverty, he fed them, he provided for them, and he calls his followers to do the same. And here's the good news, is that God is taking care of people who are less fortunate, people who are impoverished, people who are the victims of injustice. You might have had a church culture that told you that the gospel is that Jesus is our substitute, that Jesus died in our place so that we don't have to die that same death. And because of that, we can live the life that Jesus lived. Probably starts with the fact that we're sinful and that we could never be what we're supposed to be. So Jesus took our place on the cross. He died for us. You might think that Jesus is the ultimate example, that Jesus, he showed us exactly how we're supposed to live. He showed us what a life of faith looks like and of obedience and how to relate to God. And so he becomes our great example and we are to follow him. You might think of the fact that Jesus has defeated death and evil, that there's a story of the resurrection, that though Jesus was crucified, he was resurrected from the dead, which means that sin and death are not final, that they don't define us, that it's not the end, that life is victorious because God is victorious and he is a God of love and a God of life. And so we know that death and evil don't win the day, not in the end. God will recreate all things. And the reality is that all of these things, and we could probably list a whole bunch more, are aspects of the gospel. They're actually all really important things for us to understand and to think through and to try and piece together and have logic to try and explain. But one of the things that we inevitably do, and I think it's partially because we want to boil down everything to it. We're kind of a headline culture. Just give me the headline. Just give me the one thing I need to know, the one thing I should tell my friends, the one thing I need to share with people. And as we tend to do that, we emphasize one thing over the other. And the problem is not that these are wrong things. The problem is that when we only emphasize one of them, we end up de-emphasizing the rest of them. And here's the great message right at the beginning of the book of Mark. He says, this, everything I'm about to write to you, is the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. Everything that follows, everything I'm about to tell you, this is good news. Take it all in. And we might wrestle with that and say, oh, but just give me the sound bite. But Mark doesn't do that. His entire story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is good news. In other words, and I hesitate because I just told you we shouldn't be looking for the sound bite necessarily, but here's my sound bite if I had to do it. The good news is Jesus. The good news is Jesus. Jesus is what God is up to in the world. Jesus speaks on God's behalf. Jesus shows us what God is like. Jesus shows how God would act. Jesus shows us all about what we need to know. And the good news is Jesus. And so when we start to put all the things about Jesus and what he does and who he is and how he acts and his crucifixion and his resurrection, all of that together becomes the good news of Jesus. And the wonderful, wonderful thing Mark shows us right at the beginning is, here's the gospel. It's good news. It's Jesus. And I'm going to tell you all about him. And I'm going to invite you to follow and to find out what it's going to look like and to find out how he could transform your life and to find out how he can transform and has transformed the world, continues to transform the world. Come follow. Come and see. Come and experience. Come and think. Come and reason with other people. This good news, this royal announcement, God's King has come into the world. And then a couple of things happen for Mark right at the beginning of his gospel that he wants to talk about. He skips a bunch of stuff that we get excited about, like Christmas. Doesn't even mention it. The birth of Jesus, not on his radar. We don't get anything about his childhood from Mark. And he dives right into a couple of important events. The first one is the baptism of Jesus. And this is important because the first couple of things we'll talk about is Mark, when he writes his gospel, he wants to show us that Jesus is doing what the people of Israel couldn't do. The people of Israel were always called to be a blessing right from the beginning of their heritage, to be a blessing to the entire world. That was their job. But as you read through the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, we find out that there's some good moments, but there's a lot of moments where they just can't come through, where their faith dwindles, where they lack obedience, where they don't follow through on who they've been created to be and called to be. And Mark puts a couple of events in that show us that what Jesus is doing, and symbolically at first, is he is going to be what Israel as a people was always called to be by God. He was going to represent them. And so the first event, we don't have time to pick it apart this morning, but the first event is his baptism. So Jesus goes out into the wilderness of the Jordan River, and there's this guy named John the Baptist. John the Baptist is wearing really weird clothes and eating bugs. He's a strange character. You go, why is he doing that? John the Baptist, he's dressed up and acting like Elijah. Elijah's a great prophet, the people of Israel going hundreds of years back. And so when you read this weird stuff about John the Baptist and you don't understand it, it's because he's acting symbolically like he's Elijah. Elijah was this prophetic figure that the Jews had started to believe was going to come back right before God's anointed Messiah was going to appear. And so John is out there saying, I'm preparing the way. And he's looking and acting like Elijah, telling people, yeah, you're waiting for Elijah. This is the time. And God is doing something new, and God is bringing his Messiah into this world. And then Jesus shows up, and he gets baptized by John. He's out of the Jordan River. Now, if you're an Israelite, this is significant scenery. The Jordan River was the last hurdle they needed to get into the promised land, the land that God had given them and was leading them to. They had been wandering around in the desert for 40 years, and their last hurdle to get into that land where they believed God was going to bless them and give them the kind of life that they were promised all along was to cross through the Jordan River. And so John's out there, and he's baptizing people in the Jordan River. He's putting them all the way under and bringing them up. He's telling them, you need to go through the right motions. You need to go through the right heart motions, the forgiveness of sins to come into the blessing of God. And Jesus comes out, and he gets baptized there, saying just like the Israelites needed to trust in God, they needed to trust in God all the way through to get through the Jordan River and into the promised land. That's what this is all about, but on a different level. It's not about the land anymore. In fact, it was maybe never ultimately about the land. It was about our trust, but he's out there, and he's symbolically going through what Israel as a people had to go through, expressing their trust and faith in a God who was going to lead them all the way. And then the second event that happens is what we're going to talk about today. If we skip down into verse 12, I just want to read you a couple of verses. It says this. This is just after the baptism of Jesus. It says, the Spirit then compelled Jesus to go into the wilderness where he was tempted by Satan for 40 days. He was out among the wild animals and angels took care of him. So if you're an Israelite and you know your history, because they would always talk about their history and what God had been doing and what their ancestors believed about their relationship, you pick up on the imagery of the Jordan River and what Jesus was symbolically doing there. Just like our ancestors had to trust God to bring us through the Jordan River. Jesus is showing that we need to trust God for our new life. And then he goes out into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted. And again, if you're an Israelite, there's a couple of words in those sentences that really pop out to you. One, you know the wilderness, you know the desert, because the stories of your ancestors were about the 40 years that they wandered in the desert. They were slaves in Egypt, and they were called out of Egypt, and that was great. They were no longer slaves. They were free, but they ended up in the desert. And for 40 years, they wandered. And they were tested. Because all along, it was a tough journey. Almost right away, we talked about this last couple of weeks, actually. Almost right away, we're hungry. We're thirsty. Maybe we should go back to Egypt. Yeah, they go out into the desert, and there's this great story of Moses going up the mountain to get the law of God, to hear from God. And while the people are waiting, it's like, you know, you're reading this story, and you get the picture. It's like 10 minutes pass, and they go, we need another God. I don't know if we can trust God. It's like Moses up there talking to him. And they build this calf, this golden calf. Maybe we'll trust him. We'll trust this other God for what we need. And the people knew. There's this story that the Israelites wander through the desert, and they're tested because life isn't what it looks like it should be. It doesn't feel like it should be. They're not in the promised land. They're not experiencing what they think is God's blessing. It's hard. And all along the way, they're tempted. Tempted to go back to Egypt. tempted to turn to other gods and depend on other gods for the kind of life they have, tempted to give up. It's just too hard for them over and over and over. And Mark, it's interesting. It's just such a short little couple of sentences that he talks about the temptation of Jesus, obviously alluding to this time of that Israel did it. So Jesus is doing, again, what Israel couldn't do, because Israel complained. Israel, their faith wavered. They were disobedient. They struggled the whole way through. Jesus goes out there. Now, Matthew, when we read Matthew, he tells the same story, but he goes into detail about the kind of temptations that Jesus endures. He's out there with the Satan, the accuser, the adversary to God. And in Matthew, he says, you know, and then the Satan offers him this, and he comes back and quotes scripture, and he stays strong. He's got faith in his Father. And then Satan comes back with another temptation, but Jesus stays strong. He goes through three different ones. But Mark doesn't give us any of that. No, that's important. It's like almost he just wants us to think of the Israelites. And maybe he wants to think about us. Do you ever feel like you're in a desert? He's talking to people that knew about their ancestors in the desert. You ever feel like your ancestors? Your life's not what it should be. You expect to be further ahead. You expect things to be easier. You expect things to be better. And in those moments, you look around, and it's one thing to say that you're supposed to trust in God, but you start looking around and saying, maybe there's a different way. Maybe Egypt's the way. Maybe there's another God who's going to pay closer attention, get us through this faster. And I actually think, here's the thing about temptation that I think even the Israelites would have experienced. The temptation that I think Mark is alerting us to is it's getting all the right things in all the wrong ways. That's what makes temptation tempting. See, most of us, we're not tempted by really bad, horrible things. Sometimes I think that's what we think. Oh, we're tempted to do things that we shouldn't do that are horrible. It's kind of true, but it's not how it starts. We're tempted that we want really good things for our lives, good things for the people around us, good things for our families. The real temptation is going about that in the wrong ways. And I think that's Israel. I think Israel, most of the people probably wanted to be a blessing. They wanted to experience God's blessing. They wanted to have a good relationship with him. They wanted a good relationship with other people. Who doesn't want those things? But when you're in the desert, and when you're hungry, and when you're thirsty, and when you're not getting the results that you thought you were going to get, it's easy to start looking around and say, how do I get what I want? How do I get the results? And to be tempted to go to places that maybe we shouldn't go. In the desert, we might think of it this way. I think the Israelites struggled to trust God and endure hardships. How do we really trust that God has our best interest, the best interest of this world, when things are so, so difficult? I think they were tempted to take shortcuts. Man, is there an easier way? Could we just lop off some time? Why can't we just get there? Maybe there's another God that'll get us there faster. I think they focused on outward results more than inward integrity. If we're just in the land, everything will be good. However we get there, and whoever we are, I think they wanted what was fast instead of what lasts. End our suffering, end the hardships. We just want to be able to move forward. I think they sought what they could achieve rather than who they were. We see that all the time when they were called to go to different cities and conquer different places. They were so scared sometimes, and other times they were too proud. It was all based on what they thought they could do instead of who they really were. I think they were focusing on their competence more than their character. Can we do this? Can we achieve it? Can we be victorious? Can we overcome? Does any of that sound familiar? Do you ever feel like you're in the desert? Like your life just isn't lining up with where you thought it would be. You don't have the results. And are you ever tempted to take shortcuts? Do you ever focus on what everybody can see instead of what's going on where nobody can see it? Do you ever want results in your life so fast that you would do anything to get there instead of investing what's really going to last in your life and your character? Do you ever focus so much on the things that you can achieve, the successes that you could list and tell people, put on your profile, brag about? Do you ever find yourself focusing on all the ways that you can do things, what you're good at, maybe even what you're not good at, instead of who you really are deep down inside of you? I'll tell you this, we live in a culture, in a world that prizes results. It prizes and celebrates the things that everybody can see. And we have this incredible temptation, I believe, to try and identify ourselves or build up ourselves or state our identity on what we can do, what we can project, what other people can see, what is superficial, what we can post on social media, what we can prove, instead of who we really are. And I think the message right at the beginning of Mark that he wants us to understand about the life of Jesus, because I read that and I say, I don't know, Mark, you skipped a lot of stuff. Skip the birth of Jesus, skip the childhood of Jesus, skip a whole bunch of stuff, right to his baptism. And then he goes out and he's tempted. And you're thinking, this is the anointed one. This is the Son of God. It says it right there in the first couple of verses. Why doesn't Jesus go out and just start rocking the world? Just do the miracles. Just perform the signs. Allow people to have awe and wonder. Go change the world. Go prophetically speak to the systems, the religious systems and the political systems of the world, and just change the world. Jesus, just go do it. But he stops and says he went out into the desert and he was tempted, just like the Israelites were tempted, just like all of us are tempted. Because I think Jesus understood. I think this is the way that God works. That before you go out and before you can do all these things and before you can show all this stuff and before everybody sees everything, you need to look inward and build a strong foundation of faith. And so Jesus goes out and he's tempted in the wilderness, in the desert, where things are hard and tough, where it says there's wild animals, just signifying that it's a dangerous place to be tempted, to be tried, to be asked hard questions about what's inside and where his faith is. A foundation with which he can go out and actually do what God had called him to do. And I don't know about you, but oftentimes I'm tempted to believe that everything that really matters is the things that people can see and the things that I can project, the things that are superficial. But the reality is the things that are really important in life, you can't fake. You can't just have a persona that you put out there. You know what I mean? You can fake a lot of things, but not what's important. You can fake your appearance, but not your health. You can get all the right makeup and clothes that make you look good. You can take selfies from the right angle and in the right lighting and post them. You can make everybody think that you look just the way you want to. But you can't fake your health. You can't fake a blood test. You can fake popularity, but not intimacy. You can have all the parties and all the people and a zillion friends on a superficial level. You can never be alone, but you can't fake looking somebody that you love in the eye and sharing yourself and having them share the deepest part of themselves with you. You can fake success and let everybody know all your achievements and all your promotions and all the ways that you got ahead, but you can't fake integrity. What you do when nobody's looking and the things that nobody know. You can fake fun and you can post on Instagram all the best vacations and all the great things that you do and how packed your weekend is, but you can't fake happiness. At the end of the day, when you lay your head on your pillow, whether or not you're really fulfilled and happy. You can fake morality. You can do all the stuff that makes you look like you're a good person and everybody approves of you and thinks that you follow the letter of the law, but you can't fake goodness deep down. You can fake wealth, but not contentment. You can fake importance, but not meaning. You can fake power, but not self-control. You can fake competence, but not character. You can fake relaxation, but not peace. You can fake religion. But here's the point. You can't fake following Jesus. Because to follow Jesus, before all the stuff that people might see, before all the stuff that works its way outward, following Jesus is following him into the desert. Into the places where you don't see the results, the places where your life might not be where you think it ought to be, into the places that are hard, into the places where you're tempted to depend on something and someone else other than God himself. And Jesus doesn't skip over that. The Son of God himself doesn't say, oh, I just showed up, let me do my thing. He goes through the temptation. He becomes what Israel could never be. And he calls us to follow him out there into the desert where it's difficult. And some of you might feel like you're there right now. Jesus is the good news. Shows us the way through. Shows us a different way to live. Says the desert doesn't define us, but the desert does refine us. In the desert, we find out who we are. And we have opportunity to grow deeper in our faith, a trust in God that allows us to obey the things he's called us to do, because we start to become the people he's called us to be. Some of you guys, you're there right now. Some of you students, in the next couple of weeks, as you go through exams, you're going to be tempted to believe that the most important thing you do over the next couple of weeks is your grades. Don't believe it. For some of us, we're building our identity on how much we make or social media profiles. Or showing up to church and hoping that our family can pretend like we're well-behaved and we love each other for long enough so that people will think that we're the model family. Or we're striving to be moral in the things that everybody else can see so that we can try and prove that we're good people. And Jesus calls us out to the desert to take a good hard look at what's happening under the surface, way deep down, even when it's tough, even when we're tried, even when we're tempted. Our culture focuses and celebrates so much on results, but we need to focus on our process of growth, deepening that faith, following him. See, I believe what one of the things this tells us is that God's plan to win over the world starts with winning over the soul. How's this world going to be transformed? It's going to start deep inside of us, attaching our trust to a God who loves us. And I don't say this because I don't think that our faith is supposed to be personal. Our faith is supposed to be personal, but not private. It doesn't mean that our faith just means, oh, it's just all about me and what happens in a dark corner and nobody else has to know about it. It's not what I'm saying, because I think the message of Jesus, Mark makes it clear, is political and it's social and it's spiritual. It's everything, and it's meant to transform the world. Through Jesus, the world will be transformed. But it starts deep inside of our souls, asking ourselves, what do we trust? Who do we trust? Even when it's hard and even when we're not getting the results, even when we're not sure how the good news is going to line up with what we think our lives should look like in the future. So here's my question to you. What are you doing each day to foster faith and spiritual growth? What are you doing when nobody's looking? What are you doing to build that trust? And for those of you in life groups, I hope this week that you'll really unpack that with other people and ask, what are you doing? What are you doing? How do you focus on what's happening deep inside of you? How do you focus on whether or not you trust God? How do you identify the areas of in your life where you're looking for shortcuts, you're looking for results, you're looking to be superficial? And it's time to drill down deeper and ask some hard questions in your life. You know, if you're hoping the result that you'll have amazing kids that grow up to be followers of Jesus and have a family that can be identified that way, it's going to be about the small, faithful things you do day in and day out, not expecting a fast result tomorrow. It's going to be about the way that you raise and foster your children, love them and care for them. If you want to become the kind of person that is joyful and peaceful, caring, loving, self-disciplined, it's going to be about the small, faithful things that you do each and every day that nobody else sees to connect your trust with God. If you want to be a person who has honest character and integrity, it's not going to be about all the things that you can list on a resume. It's going to be about how you deal with every little situation. If you want to care for needy people, it's hard to imagine that tomorrow you can wake up and have the inner strength to go and meet all the needs that you see around you. It's going to be about starting with where your heart is, connecting with a God of love and life, and allowing him to change you deep within as you trust him. And when I think about that, you know, you think, man, if you put yourself in the place of someone in the desert, you think, this is hard. And I think we know what the emotions are like with that. It's tiring. Sometimes we think, I don't know if I can be good enough. I don't know if I have enough power. I don't know if I have enough competence. I don't know if I have enough character. I don't know if I have enough trust. And we walk through the desert and we wish that we were in the promised land and we wish that we were making a huge impact in the world and we wished we were already the kind of people that we imagined we might be. And maybe you sat there and you said, what does it look like? I mean, how do I get there? And what is that kind of life going to look like? And we go back and just one verse before, in verse 11, I think we see these powerful words. We go back to the baptism of Jesus. Say, man, how does Jesus get through the desert? How does he get through with that kind of trust? How could I build that kind of strength in my spiritual life? In verse 11, as Jesus is baptized, and it says this dove descends, something like a dove descends, the Holy Spirit upon him. And then in verse 11, a voice from heaven, God's voice says to him, you are my dearly loved son. And you bring me great joy. And I think when Jesus went out, he was tempted. And certainly when he felt what we all feel, looking for an easier answer, looking to get out of a tough spot, looking to endure, I think what gave him the strength to persevere was going back to those words he heard from his father that created the relationship they have. You are my son. You're dearly loved, and you bring me great joy. Today, I hope that you'll hear those same words. That in whatever desert you might be going through of your life, and whatever temptation you might be facing, and whatever it is that is seeking to knock you off your faith, you might come back to these words, however hard it might seem. You are my dearly loved daughter. You are my dearly loved son. And you bring me great joy. It's good news. Good news of what God already thinks of you. Good news of God's presence. And you might say, that does sound like great news, but I can't imagine what my life will be like. What is this going to be? What's the result going to be in 5 years or 10 years? What is Jesus going to do? How do I get there? I can't even picture it. And I think as we go through the book of Mark, and as we go through life, the answer we often hear from Jesus will be this: come and follow me, and you'll find out. Heavenly Father, today I want to lift up anybody who feels like they're in a desert, anybody who feels like they're tempted to take shortcuts, tempted to depend on someone or something other than you, tempted to give up because life is too difficult, tempted to be superficial, live a life based on results. God, today, by your Spirit, would you speak to us way deep down? Would you assure us that we are your children who you love? God, thank you for good news that the world desperately needs, the good news of Jesus. And even as we go through trials and temptation, even as we walk through deserts, God, give us strength as we hear the words that you spoke to him, and I believe you speak to us, that we are your loved children, and that you find great joy in us. God, drill that down deep into our hearts such that it would build strength and foundation for a life of following Jesus. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.